Ruling in the Name of Knowledge. Americans have pondered these questions before. The profession's claims of superior authority and of a monopoly on the power to prescribe rubbed early Americans the wrong way, and in the first decades of the Republic, the country reacted harshly against them. In the Jacksonian period, a time of profound anti-aristocratic feeling, the ideology of merit clashed in America with the ideological egalitarianism of the political system, as the sociologist Magali Larson writes. It was impossible to reconcile equality, Americans believed, with the professional ideal of a legally sanctioned clique of experts. Cartels and monopolies were in bad odor back then, and the public rebelled against the professions as attempts to maintain aristocratic entitlement through mystification and concealment, as an 1835 newspaper put it. Many states in those days took the revolt against professionalism so far as to repeal medical licensing requirements. The anti-professional spirit persisted for decades. The Farmers' Alliance and the Knights of Labor, two 19th-century workers' organizations, specifically excluded lawyers from membership. I myself have seen a populist-inspired sculpture garden in western Kansas in which a figure labeled Labor is crucified by statues representing the professions: doctor, preacher, lawyer, banker. Amid the enormous strikes and the sudden catastrophic recessions of the Gilded Age, however, a group of reformers who came to be known as progressives came to see professionalization as a positive thing, indeed as the only hope for a society being torn apart in the war between capital and labor. Professionals, recast now as an enlightened managerial class, were supposed to bring about an industrial peace that would be impossible under the profit motive alone. The progressives of this period could be frankly and openly elitist on the subject. Herbert Croly, the author of the seminal work The Promise of American Life, and later a founder of the New Republic, openly advocated for a sort of neo-aristocratic order led by exceptional citizens. And left-wing critics ranging from Thorsten Veblen to R.H. Taney imagined capitalism tamed by professional expertise. The progressives had a point. Many of the industrial world's problems were and are highly technical ones that require the attention of well-trained experts. Markets could obviously not be counted on to bring about democratic solutions to the scourge of exploitation, layoffs, and workplace injuries. There were no easy Jeffersonian ways around these problems. For many years, the progressive ideal seemed like a brilliant success. Franklin Roosevelt's Brain Trust, for example, still stands today as a symbol of the liberal possibilities of professionalism, as do the New Deal's many interventions in the working of the market. Economies could be managed, at least in part. World wars could be planned and won. An assortment of consumer goods could be essentially guaranteed to each and every member of the broad middle class. The administration of FDR was something of a golden age for government by professionals, although, as we shall see, one that was different in important ways from our current regime of rule by expert. Let me confess here a nostalgia for the managerial professionalism that I have just described. It was, after all, the system that administered the country's great corporations, its news media, its regulatory agencies, and its welfare state in the more benevolent years of the American century. Here and there, in certain corners of our national life, this older organizational form still survives, keeping our passenger jets from exploding and our highway bridges from collapsing. But generally speaking, that system of professionalism was long ago subverted and transformed into something different and more rapacious. Today we live in a world of predatory bankers, predatory educators, even predatory healthcare providers, all of them out for themselves. The corruption of the professions is a grand story in its own right, and one that parallels the story told in this book. It starts at roughly the same time, it features a number of the same characters, and so on. With a few exceptions, however, it is not my subject here. What concerns us instead are popular attitudes toward the professions, and by the 1970s, they were definitely starting to sour. Technocracy was the new term for describing the reign of professionalism, and its connotations were almost entirely negative. Rule by expert, it began to seem, excluded rule by the people. It was dehumanizing and mechanical. In a technocracy, the important policy decisions were made in faraway offices that were insulated from the larger whirl of society. The people making the decisions identified far more with society's rulers than they did with the ruled, and their decisions often completely ignored public concerns. Busing was one of the era's classic examples of failed technocratic overreach. Another was the Vietnam War, a catastrophic intervention in which tens of thousands of working-class Americans were sent to their deaths, not to mention the vast death toll among the Vietnamese themselves, and all of it largely because foreign policy professionals in Washington were unwilling to listen to voices from outside their discipline bearing uncomfortable news. The problems of technocracy were never solved. Instead, technocracy became a way of life with its own mass constituency. Today, as we are so often reminded, we live in a post-industrial age, and in this advanced state of civilization, the demand for expertise has become enormous. Knowledge industries such as software, finance, communication, surveillance, and military contracting are the vital economic sectors of our time, and the corporate world has proceeded to bulk up with armies of middle managers, efficiency experts, laboratory scientists, and public relations specialists. As the professional managerial class grew, its political alignment also changed. Between the Eisenhower era and today, professionals undertook a mass migration from the Republican to the Democratic Party for reasons that will become apparent as we proceed. In fact, according to the sociologists Jeff Manza and Clem Brooks, professionals went from being the most Republican social formation in the country in the 1950s to being the most Democratic by the mid-1990s. Professionalism is post-industrial ideology, and today the Democrats are the party of the professional class. The party has other constituencies, to be sure, minorities, women, and the young, for example, the other pieces of the coalition of the ascendant. But professionals are the ones whose technocratic outlook tends to prevail. It is their tastes that are celebrated by liberal newspapers, and it is their particular way of regarding the world that is taken for granted by liberals as being objectively true. Professionals dominate liberalism and the Democratic Party in the same way that Ivy Leaguers dominate the Obama cabinet. In fact, it is not going too far to say that the views of the modern-day Democratic Party reflect in virtually every detail the ideological idiosyncrasies of the professional managerial class. Liberalism itself has changed to accommodate its new constituents' technocratic views. Today, liberalism is the philosophy not of the sons of toil, but of the knowledge economy, and specifically of the knowledge economy's winners, the Silicon Valley chieftains, the big university systems, and the Wall Street titans who gave so much to Barack Obama's 2008 campaign. Liberal thinkers dutifully return the love, fussing over their affluent, highly educated sweethearts with all manner of flattering phrases. These high-achieving professionals are said to be the wired workers who will inherit the future, for example. They're a learning class that truly gets the power of education. They're a creative class that naturally rebels against fakeness and conformity. They're an innovation class that just can't stop coming up with awesome new stuff. The phrase I will apply to them is the liberal class. A designation I borrow from the radical writer Chris Hedges, although with a pretty big caveat. The premise of Hedges' book on the subject, Death of the Liberal Class, is that the cohort behind liberal politics is disappearing or has lost its nerve. He writes to mourn their passing. I write to protest their triumph. Pop technocracy. To protest their triumph? Why would a person of vivid pink sentiments like me object to the ascendancy of any liberal group? What difference does it make if the driving force behind democratic victory comes from below or from on high? Put it a different way. What does it mean when the dominant constituency of the left party in a two-party system is a high-status group rather than the traditional working class? One thing we know for sure that it means is soaring inequality. When the left party in a system severs its bonds to working people, when it dedicates itself to the concerns of a particular slice of high-achieving affluent people, issues of work and income inequality will inevitably fade from its list of concerns. We know this, for starters, because this is exactly what has happened. Issues of income inequality have been recontextualized so thoroughly in our time that certain Democrats even have trouble understanding what their forebears of the 1930s and 40s meant when they talked about the subject. For our modern liberals, it is obvious that careers should be open to talent, and it is an outrage when barriers of any kind prevent the able from rising to the top. Another term for this understanding of equality is meritocracy, which is one of the great defining faiths of the professional class. Meritocracy is about winners and ensuring that everyone has a chance to become one. The areas in which the left has made the most significant progress, writes the journalist Chris Hayes, gay rights, inclusion of women in higher education, the end of de jure racial discrimination, are the battles it has fought or is fighting in favor of making the meritocracy more meritocratic. The areas in which it has suffered its worst defeats, collective action to provide universal public goods, mitigating rising income inequality, are those that fall outside the meritocracy's purview. Another reason we know that a party of professionals will care little about inequality is because professionals themselves care little about it. While this segment of the population tends to be very liberal on questions of civil liberties and sexual mores, the sociologist Stephen Brint tells us that professionals are not at all liberal on economic and equality-related issues. On anything having to do with organized labor, as we shall see, they are downright conservative. The problem with such broad-brush generalizations about any social stratum, of course, is that there are lots of exceptions, and a group of educated and often sophisticated individuals naturally contains lots of honorable folks who care sincerely about society's well-being. Many of them understand the madness of a deregulated market system as it spins out of control. But in a sweeping sociological sense, professionals as a class do not get it. This is because inequality does not contradict, defy, or even inconvenience the logic of professionalism. On the contrary, inequality is essential to it. Professionals, after all, are life's officer corps. They give the orders. They write the prescriptions. Status is essential to professionalism. According to the sociologist Larson, achieving a more exalted level in life's hierarchy is the most central dimension of the professionalization project. What she means when she writes this is that inequality is what it's all about. Sometimes the privileges accorded to the professions are enshrined in law. Not just anyone is allowed to step into a courtroom and start pleading before a judge, for example. And even when they aren't, they're maintained by artificial scarcity, by what Larson called, in her classic 1977 book on the subject, a monopoly of expertise. Meritocracy is what makes these ideas fit together. It is the official professional credo, according to one group of sociologists, the conviction that the successful deserve their rewards, that the people on top are there because they are the best. This is the first commandment of the professional managerial class. These days, meritocracy has come to seem so reasonable that many of us take it for granted as the true and correct measure of human value. Do well in school, and you earn your credential. Earn your credential, and you are admitted into the ranks of the professions. Become a professional, and you receive the respect of the public, plus the nice house in the suburbs, and the fancy car, and all the rest. Meritocracy makes so much sense to us that barely anyone thinks of challenging it except on its own terms. For President Obama, for example, belief in meritocracy is a conviction of the most basic kind. Obama's faith lay in cream rising to the top, writes Jonathan Alter in his account of the early days of the Obama presidency. The president believed this, Alter continues, for the most personal of reasons, because this was the system that had propelled him to the top, because he himself was a product of the great American post-war meritocracy. Alter continues, he could never fully escape seeing the world from the status ladder he had ascended. Obama proceeded to fill his administration with the graduates of the most prestigious universities and professional schools, in turn causing David Brooks to feel such optimism for the country. At some level, Alter writes, Obama bought into the idea that top drawer professionals had gone through a fair sorting process, the same process that had propelled him and Michelle to the Ivy League, and were therefore in some way deserving of their elevated status. What this doctrine means for the politics of income inequality should be clear: a profound complacency. For successful professionals, meritocracy is a beautifully self-serving doctrine, entitling them to all manner of rewards and status because they are smarter than other people. For people on the receiving end of inequality, for those who've just lost their home, for example, or are having trouble surviving on the minimum wage, the implications of meritocracy are equally unambiguous. To them, this ideology says, forget it. You have no one to blame for your problems but yourself. There is no solidarity in a meritocracy. The very idea contradicts the ideology of the well-graduated technocrats who rule us. As we shall see, leading members of the professional class show enormous respect for one another, what I will call professional courtesy, but they feel precious little sympathy for the less fortunate members of their own cohort, for the adjuncts frozen out of the academic market for tenure, for colleagues who get fired, or even for the kids who don't get into good colleges. That life doesn't shower its blessings on people who can't make the grade isn't a shock or an injustice. It's the way things ought to be. This has all sorts of important consequences for liberalism, but let us here take note of just one before proceeding. Professionals do not hold that other Democratic constituency, organized labor, in particularly high regard. This attitude is documented in study after study of professional class life. One reason for this is because unions signify lowliness, not status. But another is because solidarity, the core value of unions, stands in stark contradiction to the doctrine of individual excellence that every profession embodies. The idea that someone should command good pay for doing a job that doesn't require specialized training seems to professionals to be an obvious fallacy. The panacea of education. It is not a coincidence that the two most successful Democratic leaders of recent years, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, were both plucked from obscurity by prestigious universities. Nor is it surprising that both of them eventually signed on to a social theory in which higher education is the route to individual success and to national salvation as well. Educational achievement is, after all, the foundation of the profession's claim to higher status. It should not surprise us that the liberal class regards the university as the greatest and most necessary social institution of them all, or that members of this cohort reflexively propose more education as the answer to just about anything you care to bring up. College can conquer unemployment as well as racism, they say. Urban decay as well as inequality. Education will make us more tolerant. It will dissolve our doubts about globalization and climate change. It will give us the STEM skills we need as a society to compete. The liberal class knows, as a matter of deepest conviction, that there is no social or political problem that cannot be solved with more education and job training. Indeed, the only critique they will acknowledge of this beloved institution is that it, too, is not meritocratic enough. If we just launch more charter schools, give everyone a fair shot at the SAT, and crank out the student loans, then we will have done all it is humanly possible to do. To the liberal class, every big economic problem is really an education problem, a failure by the losers to learn the right skills and get the credentials everyone knows you'll need in the society of the future. Take inequality. The real problem, many liberals believe, is that not enough poor people get a chance to go to college and join the professional managerial elite. Driving this point home is the object of report after report from the Hamilton Project, a Democratic think tank that is named, tellingly, for the original advocate of an American ruling elite. Other leading members of the liberal class have flogged the point relentlessly over the years. A brief sampling. If there is an income divide in America, it is over education, wrote Democratic media strategist Bill Knapp in the Washington Post in 2012. And this makes sense. People who are better educated should make more money. What I fundamentally believe and what the president believes, Arne Duncan, Obama's Secretary of Education, told a reporter in 2012, is that the only way to end poverty is through education. The best way by far to improve economic opportunity and to reduce inequality is to increase the educational attainment and skills of American workers, declared Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke to the graduating class at Harvard in 2008, a group much perturbed by inequality. Thomas Friedman, Obama's other favorite newspaper columnist, comes back to the subject again and again. The biggest issue in the world today is growth. And, in this information age, improving educational outcomes for more young people is now the most important lever for increasing economic growth and narrowing income inequality, he wrote in 2012. In other words, education is now the key to sustainable power. To the liberal class, this is a fixed idea, as open to evidence-based refutation as creationism is to fundamentalists. If poor people want to stop being poor, poor people must go to college. But of course, this isn't really an answer at all. It's a moral judgment handed down by the successful from the vantage of their own success. The professional class is defined by its educational attainment. And every time they tell the country that what it needs is more schooling, they're saying inequality is not a failure of the system. It is a failure of you. This way of thinking about inequality offers little to the many millions of Americans, the majority of Americans, in fact, who did not or will not graduate from college. It dismisses as though a moral impossibility the well-known fact that there have been and are places in the modern world where people with high school diplomas can earn a good living, like, say, the northern states of the USA between 1945 and 1980, or the Germany of today. Then there are disturbing reports like the recent study showing that, in terms of wealth, Black and Hispanic college graduates actually fared significantly worse in the late recession than did members of those groups who hadn't gone to college. The people in question were the ones who did everything right, who went through life the way our society instructs us to, and they were punished for it. And that's only the beginning of the problems. Who is to say that a college degree by itself is the silver bullet? In the arms race of merit, perhaps it's getting straight A's that makes you worthy, or going to a good school, or studying the STEM subjects, or not wasting time on the STEM subjects. Even then, the education panacea offers nothing to the ones who check every box and who still find, after they graduate, that there's simply no jobs out there, or that the jobs that exist pay poorly. But nothing can dissuade the leaders of the liberal class from this faith. Not the many scandals reverberating through the universities, not the much-discussed misery that has engulfed high-achieving humanities PhDs, not the crushing weight of the student loans, not the perverse fact that the quality of American higher ed has declined while its price tag has grown so massively. Nor can the leaders of the professional class see the absurdity of urging everyone else to do exactly as they themselves did to make their way to the top. It's as if some oil baron were to proclaim that the unemployed could solve their problems if they just found good places to drill for oil. Or as if some mutual fund manager were to suggest that the solution to inequality was for everyone to put their savings in the stock market.